In a short chat about our mental health, 1 in 7 Kiwis will go through some form of depression, which is what we want to talk about. Women are nearly twice as likely as men to experience actual major depression. A quarter of them, it's 24% for women and 15% for men, apparently. There's a lot of interesting talk about ketamine and the psychedelics, and we've probably all heard about transcranial magnetic stimulation, but it's a remedy that may seem miles away for most. At Stanford University, they've made a breakthrough with it, though. Joining us is Dr. Nolan Williams, a professor in psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford. Hello.
Hi, nice to see you, Jim.
We had your best-selling popular writer on mental illness on with us, Jenny Lawson, and I'm going to mention her again later, which is why I'm mentioning her now. And she described her version of transcranial magnetic stimulation as feeling like an invisible chisel drilling into her head, accompanied by an ice cream headache, but it certainly worked for her. Can you tell us about your modified version first, please?
The type of TMS that she had, what we'll call conventional repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation, has been around since the mid-90s as a therapeutic tool based off the technology in the mid-90s. Since then, we've learned a lot more about the brain. We've learned a lot more about how TMS works and how to use it. It still, you know, to its credit, works quite well, but it takes quite a while, you know, to get to a level where it's actually antidepressant. You know, one session a day, 5 days a week for around 6 or more weeks. What we figured out how to do is to compress that 6 weeks into a single day. And we also figured out how to find the person's kind of best TMS target based off of their brain connectivity using, you know, magnetic resonance imaging. So MRI, we've employed a much more accurate way of doing it. And so somebody can come in, get a brain MRI, and get stimulated over a series of sessions over a couple of days and be well at the end of the first day, or be well, you know, at the end of the second or third day. And that's quite useful in the context of psychiatric emergencies, to kind of get them out of that, you know, being in that place kind of mentally in a very short period of time.
That accurate way of doing it that you're mentioning, TMS sends magnetic impulses to specific parts of your brain. So how do you know what parts to stimulate? Are you doing that better than they did in the 1990s?
Yeah. So in the 1990s, it's an average, right? It's using kind of an average place based off of an average of everyone's brain, and then saying, okay, we're going to go to the same kind of skull spot. The problem is, no two brains are the same, right? And so what we're doing is we're saying, okay, we're going to develop a, you know, we're going to figure out the place to place this coil and to deliver these magnetic pulses in your brain based off of your brain's functional anatomy.
What's the difference between my brain's functional anatomy in this respect and my next door neighbor's?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I'll give you an example that doesn't involve mood. So if you're a pianist and you've been a pianist your whole life, the area of the brain that deals with motor cortex function, hand function, to be a pianist is expanded. So if I use a TMS coil and I ping and kind of deliver pulses in your motor cortex, you're gonna have this giant area that's dedicated to hand function. If your next door neighbor is a you know, world class martial artist who's been kicking for their whole life, their foot representation in their motor cortex is going to be much larger, and the hand is going to be much smaller, right? Whereas, you know, your hand area may be much larger, and the foot area, if you don't do any kind of, you know, complex like leg behaviors, is going to be much smaller, right? So, you know, our experiences can even change how our brains, what amount of our brains are dedicated to certain functions and how our brains are connected. It's the same sort of thing in the mood system. If you use TMS, what you're doing is you're kind of exercising, you're kind of buffing up that left dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. It's kind of this governor that deals in terms of perceived control, and then the person feels more in control, and they're able to kind of suppress the sadness experience once TMS has kind of effectively changed that brain circuit. But you have to be, you know, you kind of have to have the TMS coil over that area to be most effective in doing that.
If I can bring your examples of great piano playing and martial arts expertise down a notch, I mean, if I am basically hunched over a keyboard most of the day and my next door neighbor drives a truck, you can still customize, personalize this therapy for people like that.
Absolutely. So if you're, you know, typing all day and your neighbor is hunched over driving a truck all day and you're both depressed, you're both going to have a different spot in your brain that the TMS coil is going to need to be positioned, because everyone's brain is structured differently, no matter what you do.
Gee, it's fascinating. And does this get rid of the problems with previous therapy of this type, not only in targeting the brain areas, but also some of the attendant dangers over the years? The fact that you're now so specific means that it's safer?
Yeah, so TMS has a risk of seizure. You know, we've never had a seizure in any of our patients. I can't completely claim there is no risk, because we have it there. You know, you need thousands of patients to run through to know that. But a big part of the risk for TMS causing a seizure is operator error. And this takes all, you know, a lot of the operator error potential out, because it's so, it's neuronavigated, meaning we use a way of kind of looking into the brain, know where the coil is. And so it's also well controlled and kind of automated in that way. TMS is the safest medical procedure out there. It's got the lowest risk profile. Even with the conventional RTMS, it's a 1 in 30,000 risk of seizure. Where we think we really are benefiting, you know, is the speed in which this is happening and the robust improvements. And so older forms of TMS, you know, if you treated three or four people, three and a half people, one of them will experience symptomatic elimination of depression. With our methods, you know, if you treat 10 people, eight of them are going to get better from this. That's dramatic. We haven't really seen anything like that in psychiatry.
Yeah, the 80% figure of your patients experiencing remission is pretty impressive. We can probably stop talking about it as TMS, can't we? We can talk about the letters you give at Stanford Neuromodulation Therapy, SNT.
Yeah.
So TMS has been regarded typically as a last resort treatment. You're suggesting, are you, that it could be a first line of defense?
No. I'm definitely. It's still, you know, in the realm of folks who are treatment resistant. It's really, you know, a treatment for folks that have failed at least one medication.
Can I ask you why, though? Because you're saying it's a very safe method of treating depression. So would there be any downside towards using it ahead of other treatments?
Cost. I mean, I think that's the big, yeah. I mean, I think it's hard, you know, to justify, you know, kind of this elaborate treatment in people who've not failed an oral antidepressant, which is quite cheap these days, right? To get, you know, kind of a selective serotonin drug like Prozac is $4 in the United States. You know, it's covered by insurance in every country, you know, and so until you can kind of justify something like that from a cost standpoint, it's hard to say that should be first line.
So cost aside, how easy would it be to safely take, Nolan, what you do from a laboratory setting into a, you know, for example, the local depression clinic?
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be a big, you know, to make the process such that people can get it done.
you know, in a straightforward way with technicians. And so it's going to take a little bit of time to figure that whole thing out.
Jenny Lawson, the aforementioned, said that the great effects of TMS for her would tend to wear off after 9 months or so, and she would go in for another treatment. Why would that be? And have you found the same thing?
Essentially, everybody that gets TMS, they eventually need more TMS. The reason why is because you're driving the brain in a direction, in the opposite direction than depression was driving it, but slowly the brain kind of drifts back. You know, especially if people have been through depression before, the brain kind of gets wired to drift back. And then, you know, the TMS kind of drives it back into the direction that you intended. You know, and it's a big question, you know, for the field is we need to figure out ways to use the stimulation to keep people well.
We're talking with Dr. Nolan Williams, a professor in psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford. Here's my long question, if you don't mind. I've been through my life carrying with me a working definition of depression. I forget where it came from, which was frozen anger. You know, so we can't rail against the world and we derail ourselves instead. And that may not be an adequate definition. And it implies we should really have done something about unburdening ourselves before we became hopelessly despondent. But my question is this: if depression is so common, but can be alleviated by you so quickly, could it then simply be a consequence of the milieu that we're in, the modern environment? Because I'm sure we blame ourselves with depression and we still assume a long self-actualizing road out of it. But your work is starting to make it seem almost more physical than mental as an illness.
Certainly modern society has a detrimental effect on that. If you take people and you put them in the scanner and you do these sorts of experiments where you take away their control, then this brain region kind of comes offline, right? And so it seems to be a kind of critically important part of that system. And I think that's what's going on all the time in modern life. And then there are certainly people that are preloaded genetically and due to kind of family risk and all of that are kind of destined to, or, you know, very likely based off of their biology to later be depressed. And as long as they live in the modern world, they're not living in a bubble, they're going to get depressed. And for all of those individuals, you know, taking something like this and restoring that region to being functional seems to work. The signal that we're sending into that brain region is turn on, stay on, remember to stay on, right? That's the signal that's being sent into the brain with the SAINT approach. And that's pretty powerful, right? Being able to do that and being able to kind of restore someone's feelings of control. And what they'll tell you, you know, before they come in is the world's kind of grinding them down and they can't handle it. And when they're feeling better, they're like, yeah, it's bad out there, but in some ways, but I'm going to handle it. And I feel in control to be able to do that, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And depression isn't necessarily a teacher. You know, it's not necessarily our fault when we end up, you know, way down low. Yeah. What a fascinating breakthrough you've made. It's pretty big, isn't it? I mean, you can look forward maybe to the era of our grandchildren and think this might be a therapy that will obviate so many problems in the world and for people. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we certainly think that this is not just a depression. You know, we applied this in depression. We applied it through a TMS system, but we think this technology is bigger than depression, and it's bigger than, you know, using it through the TMS system. We think it's a method that can be utilized across a bunch of different stimulation approaches and across a bunch of different neuropsychiatric neurological conditions. And if that's true, then it ends up being, you know, a big deal if you can get those same sorts of numbers in those other conditions, right? That we could actually make a big dent in some of these things that cause so much suffering and have the biggest impact that we can. So,
and to do it in a day, did you ever think it would be that good?
Yeah. And so, I mean, I was very surprised. The first patient that we treated and they were well in a day, I was extremely surprised. I mean, this person came in and they looked like they needed to be in the psychiatric hospital. And by the end of the, day, they were totally normal. I was super surprised. The patient's husband was extremely surprised that because he thought she was gonna have to go to the hospital, and by the end of the day she's totally back to normal. And it was just such a striking thing. So,
and do you do follow up? I suppose you have limited resources, you can't keep track of everyone you have in the lab, but it'd be interesting to look at follow up 5 years, 10 years on, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I keep track of these guys and still get to talk to them. And our first subject in this trial is still well at 4 years.
Wow. That's impressive.
Yeah. It's pretty
deeply,
cool.
Actually. Yeah, very. Thank you so much for explaining it to us, and congratulations on the work.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for having me on the show. And yeah, I really appreciate it, Jim.
Professor Nolan Williams of Stanford University.